Welcome to Writers on Writing. I'm your host, Marie Stone. Today I'm joined by Lee Cole, who talks about his debut novel, Groundskeeping. Lee attended the University of Iowa for his MFA and shares a few of the important lessons he learned while there. The novel takes place in Kentucky, so we also chat about creating a sense of place, dialect, voice, and more. Enjoy the conversation. Lee, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So before we dive into the book, I know you grew up in rural Kentucky, and it's such a sense of place in this novel. So I was wondering if you could talk a little bit just about that growing up experience, if you knew writing was always going to be the plan and where those seeds started getting formed and your entryway into writing.
Well, you know, I was always lucky enough to have parents and grandparents and aunts and uncles who gave me books. So I was always reading as a kid. But I don't know if my, you know, notion of wanting to become a writer really solidified until probably my early 20s. I started out in college as a philosophy major, weirdly enough, which to me now seems like a completely different realm of thinking. But yeah, I became interested in writing, read a lot of short fiction starting out, a lot of Carver and Cheever. And then, you know, it was kind of always in the back of my mind. I mean, throughout my 20s, I worked a lot of odd jobs and finally went back to school and took some writing courses while I was simultaneously working at a UPS air hub in Louisville, unloading freight from airplanes. And the deal there was that they would pay for your tuition to take some writing classes. And so I was lucky enough to have some teachers there who encouraged me and told me that I should keep going and that I should apply to Iowa. And then when I got into Iowa, I was like, well, I guess I have to be a writer now. You know, it's kind of this defining moment where I was like, well, this has got to be my life.
I love that. Well, we're fellow philosophy majors, and I do think there's some advantages. I mean, you know, it was a rough time coming out of college, but there were some advantages to that stuck around about how to think and all of that. But there were a lot of unlearning of lessons. I don't know how deep into academic writing you got, but there was a lot of, you know, it's a very different way of thinking and writing than fiction, obviously. So I don't know if you had that experience of having to unlearn some academic habits.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, for me, it's philosophy was about building an argument, yeah. And writing fiction was sort of about the opposite. I think whereas in philosophy, you're sort of building premises towards some kind of conclusion, in fiction, you're just sort of posing questions and letting your characters sort of live out the complicated entanglements of those questions. And there's no obligation for the writer to come up with some kind of conclusion or resolution. So yeah, for me, it's a very different way of thinking, but I still like to read, you know, philosophy and that part of my brain I still enjoy using, but you're right that it's a very different part of a different way of thinking, I guess.
Did you do a lot of exploration of the short story form before you dove into the novel, or you went straight into this book?
I definitely was writing almost exclusively short stories for probably 5 or 6 years. And that's completely what I was working on at Iowa. You know, I think while I was at Iowa, I had this idea that I could stitch some stories together into a linked collection and call it a novel in stories, because the reality is, you know, that it's harder to sell a short story collection than a novel. And I thought that could be my way of kind of sneaking under the radar or something. But, you know, I didn't start Groundskeeping until after Iowa. I stuck around for a third year to teach and had kind of reached this desperate moment of writer's block. It was really hard for me to imagine a topic that could sustain my interest over the course of writing a novel that I would remain interested in after a couple of years, you know. And so one day I just sort of forced myself to write down, you know, what is the emotional question? What's the issue that keeps coming back that's perennial in my life? And what I came up with was the first line of the book, that when I'm home in Kentucky, I want to leave. And when I'm away, I'm homesick. And so everything that came after was inflected by that.
Well, that's a nice introduction into the novel, and I want to talk about that first line, but maybe before we talk about that first line, take us into groundskeeping and Owen's life here a little bit and talk about a little bit, unpack more of the inspiration for the novel.
So Owen is an aspiring writer who moves back to Kentucky after some time away, and he gets a job as a groundskeeper, primarily trimming trees on a college campus in Kentucky. And in exchange for that, he's allowed to take some writing classes. And it's here that he meets Alma, who comes from a very different background. Her parents are Bosnian immigrants, and she grew up in a suburb of DC, and they begin a relationship that's a secret relationship at first. So that while the events of the novel are fictional, they do have their basis in my own experiences of homesickness and working as a tree trimmer and just trying to navigate my relationship with Kentucky and with my family during a time when politics has become very personal in the past few years.
So the novel is set right before the election in 2016, or kind of right during the election. Mm-hmm. And I think that's such an electric time. I mean, every time since then has also been a bit of an electric time. But tell me a little bit about the choice of setting it then, as maybe opposed to the choice of setting it right after the election, which also, as you say, there's a Muslim immigrant woman who's, you know, plays kind of an almost starring role. She's right alongside our narrator. And what that time period afforded you, and maybe some of the difficulties and complications of writing around that time period.
I think that a lot of what happened during the Trump years was kind of a recycling of old fascist tropes, you know. So it's, in some ways, it's not new. But I do think that what made it different for a lot of people and for me is that I felt sort of blindsided by it, by the election in 2016, as a lot of people did. But then stepping away from that, I couldn't say it exactly surprised me, having grown up in a rural place and knowing the kinds of undercurrents there. So I guess for Owen and Alma, it's that their relationship, he gets involved in this relationship with her, and she comes from this really different background. And anytime you become involved with someone, there's a certain amount of self-consciousness. You're forced to sort of see yourself through their eyes. And for Owen, what that means is sort of having to confront where he comes from and his own relationship with his family and their disagreements about the way the world is. And all of that, I think, is just intensified by the atmosphere of Trump's election, if that makes sense.
So that first line of the book, which really seems to contain a lot of the DNA of the entire novel to me, which is, again, you know, I've always had the same predicament. When I'm home in Kentucky, all I want to do is leave. And when I'm away, I'm homesick for a place that never was. And then the novel really is sort of a, you know, 300-page unpacking of that idea. And mm-hmm. I always wonder when people start writing, if the first sentence, which it sounds like was the case for you, the first sentence really kind of drove, okay, let me understand that question. Let me keep posing that question to myself. Or if they write the whole book and they're like, oh yeah, that's what this was about, and that's where I should start. So I'm wondering, at what point in your discovery of what this book was that sentence came to be?
Well, like I was saying, I mean, that was sort of the first thing, was that sentence. And, you know, it's interesting, in Iowa, there's this idea of the emotional question that kept coming up for me. And for the longest time, I heard people use it in conversation, and I had no idea what they were talking about. And I'm still not 100% sure I know exactly what it is. But I think it's just the kind of, you know, the predicament that your character is caught in emotionally, you know, and that sort of serves as the motor for the book. And it sort of creates the themes for the book as well. So, you know, the emotional question in Huckleberry Finn, for instance, might be, do I light out for the territories, or do I stay and get, quote unquote, civilized by my aunt, you know? And that question sort of, there's always a push and pull throughout the novel. So for me, you know, that sentence came first. And so much of the book is about Owen sort of longing for both the familiar and the unfamiliar, and not being able to quite resolve that contradiction. And that's sort of mirrored too, I think, in the grandfather character, who, you know, had his wild days of hoboing and hopping freight trains and then serving in the South Pacific during the war. And then, you know, all he wanted to do was come back and set out a crop of tobacco in Kentucky. And it took that period of living out in the world and being a little bit wild to sort of realize that what he longed for was the familiar. And he says to the narrator at one point, the things you think are dull become the things you long for. So, you know, I think the journey of the book is kind of Owen figuring out that question. And part of it is through his relationship with Alma, and part of it is through this kind of new reckoning with his family and his origin.
And the book, we should say, is told in first person. So it's all Owen's point of view. And there's a lot of, you know, so Owen and Alma are kind of at the center of it, but there's a lot of cast of characters surrounding them, family members, workers, fellow writers. And I was wondering, because first person's tricky. I mean, you know, once you're locked in somebody's head and you can only see the world through their point of view, when especially you have all of these characters with very disparate ethnic, cultural, religious, political backgrounds, there would be a temptation, I would think, to slide into their heads and, you know, tell the story from their point of view. So I wondered if you grappled at all with that first person choice, and if nonetheless there were times that you did, you know, sort of experimental writing that never made it onto the page from the other characters' points of view.
I don't think I ever did any first person writing from the other characters' points of view, but, you know, I do think it's important in a first person project, whether it's a story or a novel, to be able to see around the narrator. And, you know, the way that you do that, I think, is by having other characters react to the narrator in a way that perhaps surprises them or, you know, sort of undercuts their narrative of themselves, you know. So at one point in the book, there's a big argument between Owen and Alma about, well, it's about material and who has the right to use material that's happens to be shared between two writers. And in that was a moment for me in which I thought, you know, I need to be able to give voice to what the reader might be thinking about Owen and put it into Alma's mouth, that so that the narrator is not a dictator or something, that he's not sort of foisting his worldview on the reader completely, that other characters get their say and that they can call out the narrator, and that you can see Owen's naivete, his bitterness, his resentment, his pettiness, that he's a flawed character as much as anyone else. And I don't think that, I think as long as you're not treating a first person narrator as the hero or as someone whose story can't be questioned, then, you know, that's always better in a first person book.
Yeah, I thought there was so much that could be learned from how you dealt with that, because you're right. He really was very fully understood as being just as flawed as the other characters. And you did that, you know, through a lot of scene setting and dialogue, of course. But also, I mean, he became, you know, pretty self-reflective of his own foibles and faults. And yeah, I just thought you handled that so adeptly that it's complicated. It's complicated to do that. Mm-hmm. And especially, you know, I think you're right, when you have to view your family through a new lens, when you're introducing them to an intimate partner, and now you're looking at your family through that person's eyes. And, you know, I think that also gave it sort of another fresh perspective of how he could see his family in a different light once he's introducing Alma to them. So this cast of characters I was going to sort of count up all of the sub minor characters, but there's probably, I mean, when you add them all up, there's probably 15 or so of them. And they're really very fully formed, depending on how much time they have on the page. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about that, about spending time with these characters, how much work you did that may or may not have been on the, you know, made it into the final cut to understand who they were. The grandfather character in particular and Owen's uncle just struck me as, you know, pretty complicated men who have a pretty rich life that probably never made it onto the page, but that you could feel, you could really sense it in there. And I was wondering if you could just talk a little bit about getting to know those guys.
You know, there were some, you know, in early drafts, I did write some material about characters that didn't quite make it in because I felt like it was too much of a digression. But the further out you get from your own experience, from your autobiographical experience, the more research you have to do. So for Alma's family, for example, I had to sort of spend several weeks, you know, a couple of months doing research for what amounted to, you know, maybe only 15 or 20 pages. A lot of, you know, the rest of the book came to me pretty quickly, but that sort of slowed things down because I wanted to make sure that I got it right. But then there were other characters like Rando, for instance, that I feel like I knew so well because I had worked with guys like that. I mean, he was sort of a composite character, but he's just such a kind of person that I've worked with. And I knew his way of speaking. I knew his jokes. You know, I just knew him. And then as far as the grandfather, I mean, that character is probably the closest to, you know, a person in my life. I based him pretty closely on my own grandfather and his experiences. And, you know, he was someone who was a great storyteller and whose stories about, you know, living during the Great Depression and being in World War II always really enchanted me as a kid. And he also had a lot of antiques, which he has in common with the character in the book. He just had a lot of like old tobacco pegs and barbed wire and, you know, just all these relics of the agrarian past, which were really special to me. So, you know, it was a mix. So for some characters, I had to do a lot of work to sort of figure out what their motivations were. But I wanted everyone to contain multitudes and to be complicated. And I tried to, anytime I felt like I knew a character too well, I tried to give them some detail that subverted that, you know, because that's just, you know, how it is in life. Anytime you think you've been able to reduce someone to a label or to a concept of who they are, they always surprise you. And I feel like when you're writing characters and trying to make them feel real on the page, you have to do the same thing. You have to let them surprise you.
Can you give an example of that for one of them that was particularly fun that you subverted who you thought they were?
Well, with the uncle, with Court, he was a difficult character because he says a lot of ugly things. And I didn't want to shy away from that because those people are real. You know, you really encounter those kinds of people, especially, you know, maybe in rural places. You know, and in the Trump years, too, that they were sort of given permission to say these ugly things. And Court is like that. But I also wanted to explore, you know, it's like once I had established who he was, that he was this man in his early 50s who was still living with his father and who spent most of his time playing a game on a computer and was very much full of bitterness and resentment. Then, you know, once you've established those details, well, then as a writer, you have to ask yourself, well, what made this character this way? No one is just evil. You know, no one is just on the face of it like a villain. So you have to think, well, what were the material conditions of this person's life? What were the economic factors, the political factors, the social factors that led to them being the way they are, that shaped them as a person? And so, you know, I sort of developed this backstory of him having this car accident when he was younger and having a, you know, a back injury that involved several surgeries, and that now he has a kind of a problem with prescription painkillers. And that, to me, it felt like it deepened him as a character and allowed me to see him as not this sort of straightforward villain.
There's a scene later in the book, and I don't think it gives too much away, where there's a conversation between Court and Owen, and Court sort of tenderly, vulnerably shares, you know, I'm the uncle and you're the nephew, and it's my job, or it should be my role, to have taught you things, and, you know, you don't look up to me. And that was the moment where I still didn't like him, but he had a bit of humanity for me. And I thought that was just such a brilliant move because, you know, we're in such a period of time, maybe we always have been, where it's easy, you're right, to reduce people to stereotypes and cliches, and it's never that way. And I just thought that's one of the moments in fiction where people reveal their humanity. And, you know, that's just the strength of fiction. Did you feel like, not that the book would have changed your opinion necessarily about anything, but Does the act of writing these characters who you might not agree with make it easier to live in the world with people who are like this?
Oh, yeah, I think it does. But, you know, what you aspire to in your writing is not always what you're able to pull off in life. I can aspire to this idea that, you know, people, this sort of Whitman-esque idea that people contain multitudes and they're complicated and you have to find that complexity. But I'm also in my life, you know, I'm human and, you know, I get angry and with people who are like Court, you know, and, you know, I'm not always as willing to give them the benefit of the doubt, though I might, you know, wish to or wish that I could. But, you know, I think that's sort of the value of teaching writing for me too, is that, you know, when I was at Iowa, I taught undergrads and for a lot of them, you know, they were taking it as an elective. It was like that they were either, you know, going to take that or like drama. So they chose, they chose creative writing because they didn't want to do drama. But, you know, and for a lot of them, they weren't going to go on to become professional writers. But my hope was that, especially during the Trump years, that they could leave my class feeling like the world was a little bit less black and white, that it was a little bit more complicated and able to, you know, cultivate empathy and to feel like, you know, people weren't reducible. You know, that was the important thing to me. And you can do that through teaching, I think, literary fiction. You know, there is a real moral element there of believing that people are complex and that every person's experience is worth writing about or that it can be written about.
So one of the areas that I think you did so well, and it would also be complicated, is the dialect. So there's a, you know, particular dialect, Kentuckian words, I guess you would say.
Yeah.
And it would be easy to turn characters into caricatures. And it almost became this game between Alma and Owen to point these phrases out in sort of a weird, like it started off as like this strange condescending thing where she was like keeping a notebook of his phraseology and kind of a, it felt at times cruel and at times, you know, documentarian, but it was a really clever way, I think, to point at differences and coming together and all of that. But anyway, I loved the way that you dealt with dialect and dialogue. And I don't know how you stumbled across that. I don't know if it's a device for her to have done that, but if that just arose naturally and if that was a way to kind of talk about the language differences between them, but it was really clever.
Yeah, well, thank you. You know, I think I sort of gathered together in Alma several experiences that I've had with people who, I don't know how to put it, that I've talked to them and told them I'm from Kentucky and maybe they're from, you know, an affluent coastal city and they find that southernness or something quaint, you know? And so that's kind of what I was trying to capture there. So the moment when she asks him to count to 11 from 9. Mm-hmm. And he says 9, 10, 11. And she's like, it's 10 with an E, not an I. Like that was based on a real experience of mine. And, you know, I think that happens. But, you know, there's a lot of interesting stuff with dialect and language in the book. I'm really excited to see how, for instance, the German translation handles the Kentucky slang, because I kind of have no idea. But I think a lot about that. I think a lot about the fact that I don't have an accent anymore. I used to when I was a kid, and I don't know if it was TV or just living elsewhere that kind of standardized my accent. But that's you know, it's something that you see in the South and in rural places in general too. It's a lot of the old sort of vernacular and folkways and idioms that are so rich and that I can hear, you know, in my grandparents' speech is fading away. I think in the next 10 years, a lot of those idioms will disappear in everyday speech. So it was important to me to try to capture them, especially in the character of Pop and the grandfather, who probably uses the most sort of slang. So yeah, that was really important to me. And those were all issues that I was thinking a lot about writing the book.
Well, and it's such a charged time to have those discussions, because I feel like if you would have written this book, I don't know, 10 years ago, pre-Hillary Clinton using the phrase deplorables and and all the connotations that I think the coastal elites tend to have, you know, with Southern accents now, it's just a very different conversation that we're having today than we would have been having, I think, 10 or 15 years ago. So it played so strongly into the plot in a way, you know, in a new way that I think it just wouldn't have a while ago, and in an important way.
No, thank you. Yeah, that question of class has really come up a lot, I think, since Trump's election, and how much empathy to extend to Trump supporters. I mean, one of the things that I found dissatisfying about a lot of the, I guess, think pieces around the 2016 election was that they wanted to reduce Trump's election to a single kind of crude explanation, you know, and part of the reason I wrote the book was that I wanted to deal with real people who are complicated, and maybe they support Trump, but, you know, their lives are more than that. They're more than just, you know, a quote unquote Trump supporter, I guess.
And it's interesting to have written about this particular time period, because now we're in the realm of a lot of pandemic, you know, a lot of discussion about writers writing about the pandemic, which is its own unique time period. And, you know, whether or not we're too close to it to write about it and have, you know, we don't know how that story really ends yet. We don't know how the Trump story really ends yet either. But, you know, I think these seismic shifts in our culture are such interesting timeframes to write about. And it's kind of interesting to figure out when to do that and, you know, how far away we have to be from it to be objective about it. And maybe the answer is never, and maybe the answer is always. I can't quite figure it out. Well, this is a good way to segue to the discussion of place, because place, and we've been talking around it, but maybe we can talk more directly at it, because place is such a character in the book. And I know you taught a class at Catapult, which I wish I had taken. It sounds fantastic. But what makes place different than setting, and how you evoke a place so clearly? Because this book, I mean, Kentucky was probably as major a character as Owen was in this book. So tell me a little bit about what is the difference between place and setting? And were you in Kentucky when you wrote this, or did you feel like you needed the distance to be away from it to write objectively about it?
Well, I wasn't in Kentucky when I wrote it. And I definitely think I needed some time away. I mean, I was visiting home. I visit, you know, pretty regularly, but no, I was living in Iowa when I wrote it. And the difference between place and setting, I mean, that's tricky. I mean, I think what I sort of came up with for that Catapult class was that setting is static, almost like the, you know, the painted backdrop in a play, and that place is dynamic, and it's always a relationship between the individual and the setting, you know. Which is constantly shifting. But I've been thinking a lot about this recently, because one of the issues I think a lot about is just the way that the South has changed, and the way that rural America is changing, kind of the Walmartification of the South, which is happening at the same time that anything that might have been associated with the agrarian past is almost completely faded at this point. It's become commodified nostalgia. It's become, you know, farming implements hanging on the wall in a Cracker Barrel. So how do you write about the South? How do you write about Kentucky in a time of uniformity, when so many little towns have become so almost interchangeable? You know, you go and you see the same things. You see McDonald's and Walmart and Dollar General, and there's this colonization of rural life by consumerism. And so how do you address that as a writer? That's a question I've been asking myself a lot lately. And one that I don't know that I touched on too much in the class that I taught, but, you know, in the 80s, there was this so-called Kmart realism, you know, of people like Carver or Bobby Ann Mason, who is another great writer from Western Kentucky. And what I think made that interesting was setting the old and the new side by side. So there were still a lot of vestiges of the agrarian South alongside shopping malls and Kmart and all of that. But now it's like, I don't know, the Walmart has won. There's no competition anymore. And so how do you write in that environment? And I don't know. I mean, I have a few ideas, but I'm not sure that any of them are especially satisfying to me, because I don't know, it almost feels wrong to put the onus on writers when it's so clearly a socioeconomic problem.
Yeah, I think it was Owen towards the end of the book that made that observation about the colonization of rural America by urban America. And I'd never thought of it in those terms, but it's really brilliant. I mean, that's exactly right. I haven't thought about it deep enough to come to strong conclusions about it.
Well, he sort of is embarrassed, I think, by it, because I think he mentions that it was an offhand statement that he made to Alma, and she's repeating it in front of her parents, who, of course, live in a city and, you know, might be offended by it. But I don't think I would say that rural America is colonized by cities necessarily, but it's more just this metastasizing consumerism that I worry about.
My guest this morning is Lee Cole. The book we're talking about is Groundskeeping. You're listening to Writers on Writing.
So we should mention, if people haven't picked it up, that so the structure of the book is it's written in two parts and there are no chapters. It's just part one and part two. Mm-hmm. And it's funny because this is kind of in contrast to an author we just had on, Weike Wang, who wrote in, she called it a collage structure of just these very short fragments. And this is sort of the antithesis of that. It's very long, you know, 150 page sections. Mm-hmm. And it struck me that would be hard. It would be hard as a writer because it's just a very long interstate as opposed to blocks where you can approach a stop sign and have a breather. For the writer, you know, you just have to keep going. And so tell me a little bit about, especially for a first novel, if that was kind of a daunting structure and if you kind of ever got lost in the weeds where you couldn't, you know, move things around. I mean, you just had to kind of get on the road and keep going.
Well, you know, you're right that it's not broken down into like numbered chapters, but there are discrete sections with page breaks. And for me, those kind of represent, well, the way I work, I guess, is I have like a million Word documents. There's something really freeing to me about being able to start a new Word document. And then, you know, once I have so many that I'm having trouble keeping them straight in my mind, then I'll sort of bring them together into one Word document and let them live together and see what happens and see if I can stitch them together. So it's kind of a patchwork approach, I guess. So the way that the book came together was just sort of taking these discrete sections that I'd written and slowly bringing them into one document. And then as far as part one and part two, I mean, the way I was thinking of it was just part one was sort of will they, won't they? And part two was now that they have, will it work? How will they stay together? And those were the two. So the tension in the first part was just, will they get together? And the tension in the second half was, will it work?
It's interesting because I wouldn't say, you know, it's not a thriller paced what's going to happen next novel. And yet it really was a page turning novel. And it really was, I can't wait to see what will happen next, even though there weren't, I mean, there was a lot at stake, but it wasn't like cliffhangers, you know? And I thought it was very interesting how you maintained suspense in a relatively, I mean, I don't want to call it a quiet novel because like I said, there were a lot of tensions and a lot of family tensions, but I don't know how much consideration you gave to how do I keep the reader turning the page and interested in what's happening next when I don't have, you know, kind of the hook of who done it and how did they do it?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's a little bit unfair, I think, to write a love story because so many of the tropes are already there. You just have to kind of remix them or subvert them in some way. But the structure is almost handed to you on a silver platter. Like you sort of know the beats of a love story. So then the question becomes, well, once you know those tropes and that structure, well, how do you surprise your reader given that they've read a million love stories? And so I think that's kind of the way that you create tension is by subverting expectations, by knowing what the tropes are, knowing what the cliches are, having read enough that you know the typical move for a scene, and then doing the opposite of that. And that, I think, keeps the reader on their toes and wanting to read more. I find, though, that if I think too much about tension in itself, that I get in my own head. I feel like it trips me up and I start sort of placing tension into scenes artificially or where it doesn't belong. So for me, it's almost like an emergent property. It arises on its own, as long as I'm subverting expectations and keeping my eye on the cliche, on the trope, and always sort of using that to either to my advantage, if that makes sense.
Well, the interesting thing about this love story is, and I'm sure there are others like it, but I can't think of them right off, is that I wasn't sure I was rooting for them, you know? And usually in a love story, you're always like, oh, I want them to be together. And here I was like, you know, I don't know. You should probably. And you're right, for that subversion of expectations, you know, I really fell in love with Owen, and I, you know, certainly wanted the best for him, and I wasn't quite sure what that was. So
yeah,
I thought that was really clever. Where were the sticking points for you? Because I feel like middles of novels are just very dreadful to write through. They're very hard. And so I was wondering if there were places in here where you just felt stuck, or you didn't understand what a character's motivations were, or where the hard parts were and how you worked through that.
I think you're right. Yeah. The middle of any project is probably the most difficult part. And in this case, because there are sort of two parts to the book, you know, I got to the end of the first half and I was like, well, is it over now? You know, like there's a lot that's unresolved, but, you know, you could almost imagine it ending there. And so then that raises the question, well, you know, if I have these ideas for a second half, are they just a separate novel? Like, you know, do they justify kind of being included here? So that was, you know, that was a question that I came to in the middle of writing it. I'm trying to think what else. I mean, making the decision to write about the families. I mean, because there's a big chunk in the second half of the book that's just Alma meeting Owen's family and Owen meeting Alma's family. And that got into territory that was difficult for me to write emotionally. And, you know, that is always a downside, I think, of autobiographical fiction, is that you have to sort of know where the line is and not be too invasive of someone's privacy, perhaps, and make sure you're fictionalizing enough. But writing about the family stuff was definitely hard.
Well, it brings up that whole question that, as you alluded to earlier, came up between Owen and Alma about whose material do you have a right to write? And which was funny in the context of, what was it, the bad friend or the secret? There was the whole New Yorker controversy about the two friends who were taking each other's material and writing about each other. And I thought, that is a risk. I mean, I think that is really an interesting story about whose story you have the right to tell. And yeah, if you're writing about family tensions, how this is going to be received, you know, everybody who picks this up is going to read themselves into whatever novel you're going to write. So you have to... You have to be aware of that. And that's really tricky. I don't know, do you feel like you had sort of a Greek chorus of family voices in your head that were getting in your way as you were writing it?
Not so much. I mean, it's just a matter of writing vulnerable stuff, which is always the best stuff. You know, it's like forcing yourself to do that. I think I go through a version of it with every project I work on. It's like, you know, if you're not having those fears, if you're not feeling vulnerable, you know, then it's probably not, you know, good. You know, that's sort of a test, I think, of the material. So it's just kind of making yourself do it, you know. And as far as like sharing material, I know, if you spend enough time kind of hanging out with writers, you know, you'll both be out and about and see something strange or hear, you know, a bit of dialogue that's interesting. And it's not uncommon for, you know, somebody to say, well, I call dibs on that. You can't take that, you know. So that tension was interesting to me. It was a tension I never really thought about until I got to Iowa, because I hadn't had occasion to spend much time with writers. But, you know, in Iowa, you're surrounded by other writers and it's a small town, you know, you're all witnessing the same events, going to the same events. So I don't know. I thought that notion of sharing material and who has a right to write about it was fascinating.
How much of a distance did you feel like you had to have from Kentucky to write about it? Like how far in time away did you have to be from it to sort of feel like, okay, I can see it somewhat objectively to write about it?
You know, it's interesting with Kentucky. I sort of started out really fictionalizing, especially Louisville. And at a certain point, it got sort of cumbersome to me. And I ended up just sort of using the real names of businesses and, you know, places that I went. The only, I think, place in Louisville that remained fictionalized was Schadenfreude, the bar that features pretty prominently. I based it on a bar called Seidenfadens in Germantown, but I just thought that Schadenfreude was too funny to get rid of. Yeah. But the rest of the bars and, you know, restaurants and stuff in Louisville, I just ended up kind of using their real names. But, you know, I don't know. I think that for any place or setting, you kind of have to have some distance, and it has to develop this aura of nostalgia or something, at least for me. So to give you an example, like, you know, I mentioned that I worked for 2.5 years at UPS, sort of unloading packages from planes. And people would always say to me, like, you know, well, you should write about that. That's fascinating. And my response would be like, no, it's completely boring. Like, I can't imagine anybody would want to read about putting packages on a conveyor belt. And I have to live it. You know, whenever they would say that to me, I would say, well, I'm living it every night. The last thing I want to do is write about it, right? But only now, several years later, am I actually trying to write about that and think about that. And I feel like I have the distance to do it. And part of that is just that it's not my everyday life, you know, so it feels somewhat, I guess, exotic to me now. So it's in some ways, it's a question of just what can you be interested in the moment? And it's harder for me to be interested in a place where I'm living, because it's just what I'm experiencing on a day-to-day basis. But if it's some place that I used to live, or there's some distance from me, then it takes on this other character of, you know, just feeling kind of freighted with emotion and nostalgia. And even now, when I go back to Western Kentucky, or I go to Louisville, it's like, it's hard for me to imagine ever living there again, because I just feel so surrounded by sentiment or something. Every place, every business, every record shop or bar, it's like I have a memory associated with it. And that's not always the case when you're immersed in it, if that makes sense.
Well, and I was thinking that with the job Owen is doing. So he's a groundskeeper on the campus and cutting trees, which you could also say, how exciting could that be?
Right.
Yet, I mean, it was metaphoric, and then, you know, it had a payoff at the end. And so there's a lot you can do with it, I think, once you step away from it and you can see sort of the metaphor and contours of it that you can't see if you're just up on a ladder cutting down a limb of a tree. Right.
So, well, at least there's there's an element of danger, at least with
that's true.
Because you're having to, you know, put on a harness and strap on a chainsaw and climb a tree, which is, you know, there's a sort of inherently tension there. But yeah, I know what you mean. And I think that's true too. Like I worked as a tree trimmer for a little while, and I did sort of write down journal entries and notes when I was doing that, but it didn't strike me as they was all kind of stewing in the back of my mind for several years before I sort of realized that I could write about it and then people might find it interesting.
There's a great short story by Adam Johnson in Fortune Smiles, that short story collection about a UPS driver. It's very
okay. I haven't read that.
Yeah, it's good. He's delivering packages during Hurricane Katrina or something. That's
really good. Wow.
Yeah. So I guess, you know, I mean, you can take anything and a good writer can make it sing. It's so funny that when Waiki Wang was on last time, I said, do you think the quotation mark will not survive the 21st century? Because I swear the last 6 books I've read, I don't think the quotation mark around dialogue is enjoying a time right now. I think it's kind of, I don't know, passé or something. And then when I picked up your book, I'm like, see, I was right. The quotation mark is dead. But the interesting thing that I find about that, so, you know, if you haven't read the book, Lee Cole does not use quotation marks around dialogue. There's always kind of an interesting psychological reason. I think it works. And it's different for each book. But as I was pointing out to her in like Jose Saramago's Blindness, the characters are blind, so you can't see who's talking. So it really made sense that, you know, you couldn't kind of see the dialogue tags. It gave you that feeling. And in hers, you know, her character is really very so interior that, you know, other people don't so much matter to her. So their dialogue doesn't matter that much. But in here, you know, he seems very, very much in his own head and kind of stream of, it kind of gave a stream of conscious feeling to the book that I thought lent well to not using quotation marks. But I thought if you gave that, you know, kind of serious consideration of the use of punctuation or lack of use of punctuation and how it served other parts of the novel that you were trying to convey.
I wish I had a really good kind of intentional reason for not using quotation marks, but I think it was mainly just that the books I was reading at the time weren't using quotation marks. So I think when I started it, I was reading Elif Batuman's The Idiot, which was a big influence, and it wasn't using quotation marks. And I liked that. I don't know. It's something about just opening up a page and it not feeling or seeming cluttered. And beyond that, I don't know if I have a really good reason. It was just something that appealed to me at the time. And now, I mean, the project that I'm working on now, I've gone back to using them. Maybe they won't survive revisions, but yeah, I mean, I just think, well, I mean, one thing I will say is that when you're dealing with a handful of main characters, I mean, you did mention there are a lot of ancillary characters, but there are really, you know, it's a lot of just conversation between Alma and Owen. And in some ways, I just sort of let those conversations go. You know, I just let them run for a while and sort of trusted that they would be interesting because they're two people who are very different, who are learning about each other. And in some ways, I was influenced by, you know, the Before Sunset movies, which, you know, are just sort of taking place in real time. And they're two people sort of having these long conversations about their lives and about art and death and philosophy and all that. But when you're in those scenes, I think, you know, you have less need for quotation marks. It's like when you have a lot of characters and you need to use a lot of dialogue tags, then they become more useful. But when it's almost more like a play or something, for me, it feels like I don't need them, if that makes sense.
And there were times when I wasn't sure if he was thinking something to himself and he had said it out loud or actually hadn't said it out loud. And then I was like, I don't know, sometimes maybe it didn't even matter, you know, that the word just kind of in his brain. It was, yeah, it was really nice.
Thank you.
So as we draw down on our time, we should mention other advice or wisdom or things that you took away either from your time in the MFA or things that you gleaned working on this novel that, you know, you find particularly helpful, or further readings, things that you're reading that you find particularly helpful or want to call out for people to pay attention to?
You know, I think one thing that was really emphasized in Iowa was just staying in scene as much as possible, which was kind of new to me. I mean, there's kind of, you know, this cult of scene writing or something at Iowa. People are very insistent on it. And I think it's because you develop your technique that way. And that maybe once you've established that, then you can write in summary and it's a little bit easier. But forcing myself to write mostly in scene was really helpful. And I think a lot of this book is mostly in scene. I mean, there's very little summary. And then the other thing that I always tell students, you know, in classes that I've taught too, is just to not worry so much about theme and symbol, that all of those are just kind of emergent properties. And that if you're just working on character and POV especially, then all of that stuff will emerge. You know, it's not something that you have to worry so much about. But if you're really immersing in POV, then the themes and symbols will sort of take care of themselves. And POV is, of course, really closely related to place and to kind of the conditions that shape a character's life. So that's always something that's really important to think about.
You made a comment, I think, in the acknowledgments about somebody who helped you really develop your voice. And I was wondering if voice was a difficult thing to establish for this, or if your voice was really found in understanding who Owen was and what drove him. Like if he was the driver of the voice, or if you feel like voice is some sort of universal thing that will follow you from book to book to book.
Well, that's a great question. I mean, I think that for me, I kept getting this feedback in workshop that my characters didn't have enough interiority. They weren't reacting internally to what was going on in the outside world. And I don't know if that's just because I was trying to emulate these very kind of laconic writer, you know, like Carver or Hemingway or something like that, and just sort of you know, failing. But I think partly for groundskeeping, I was like, okay, I'm going to write this book and nobody's going to be able to say that there's not enough interiority here. And, you know, that was really hard for me in the beginning because it's scary to write how a character is feeling. And part of that involved just writing down my own emotions and keeping a journal and writing down how I felt in reaction to certain events. And it became easier after that. But I mean, part of finding your voice too is just finding what you can say that other people aren't saying. And for me, it was for a long time, I didn't think that anybody would be interested in reading about Kentucky or my life or my experiences. I thought that what writing was, you know, people living in affluent, you know, places and kind of upper middle class, like achiever story or something, you know, and I thought that's what I would have to do. And at a certain point, it occurred to me that, you know, there wasn't a lot of fiction about working class people, because people who are in those worlds don't often make it out to write about it. You know, Lucia Berlin is a great example of somebody who did, but and one of my favorite writers, but they're few and far between. So part of finding your voice is just trusting that your own experiences are valid and that they'll be interesting if you're honest about them.
Are there other writers you want to call out that you have found helpful? I love Lucia Berlin, but are there others that you drew inspiration from this?
Yeah, I mean, I've been mentioning her a lot lately just because her book was such a revelation to me when I read it, A Manual for Cleaning Women. And then I quickly, you know, read Evening in Paradise and Welcome Home. And I just think that she has such a tenderness and warmth for humanity in her stories and such a strong sense of place, even though she moved around a lot and, you know, didn't put down roots really anywhere, but anywhere that she was, she could see it so clearly. And that's when I say she has the warmth and tenderness, I don't mean that she's sentimental or anything like that, but it's just that you can tell how interested she is in people. And, you know, of course, she's also writing about kind of these working class, you know, jobs and environments and AA meetings and that sort of thing. But she was also, you know, kind of an autodidact and had this genteel, you know, attitude almost. So that juxtaposition is really interesting to me too, that she was inhabiting these almost, you know, kind of gritty worlds, but was coming to them from this point of view of gentility almost or intellect. So yeah, she's been lately the answer changes when somebody asks you who your favorite writer is, but lately I've been saying Lucia Berlin.
That's a great one. So how do we find you? I assume you're going to do a book tour for this, at least online. I don't know how book tours are going these days in the real world, but tell us how we can follow along and make sure that we can find out more about you.
You know, I'll be going on tour. The book comes out March 1st. My first reading will be in Oxford, Mississippi, and I'll be going to, Nashville on the 3rd. I'll be at Parnassus.
Yes, Ann Patchett has such a lovely blurb on here. So that'll be fun to go to.
I know. I feel really fortunate.
Yeah, I saw a couple of people promoting your events. So we can look for you online and hopefully you're hard at work on the next one so we can talk again. I would love it.
Yeah, that sounds great.
Lee Cole, thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
That was Lee Cole. The book is Groundskeeping. You can find this and other episodes on our websites. Barbara's is barbaradeMarcoBarrett.com. Mine is mariestone.com. Or you can subscribe to the podcast on Apple, Amazon, Spotify, and Stitcher. Music, sound design, and editing by Travis Barrett. Thanks so much for joining me. Have a great day.